Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is something we hear a lot about these days and something the medical and mental health communities are doing their best to learn about and treat in more effective ways. When we talk about PTSD historically, the term shell-shocked immediately comes to mind. But a new play being put on by Combined Efforts Theater in Iowa City raises some important questions about the kinds of trauma that were experienced by soldiers who fought in World War I when the term was first introduced. Janet Schlopkohl is the founder of Combined Efforts Theater and the writer of the play Shell-Shocked. She is here with me now. Hello, Janet.
Hi. Thanks for having me in this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. And this topic has a personal connection with your life. Your grandfather fought in World War I.
Great-grandfather.
So tell me how you got interested in looking more deeply into what it means to be shell-shocked.
I was working on a book about my family's history and researching various stories, and I received from some relatives papers that were about my great-grandfather and his history. And there were things that when you're a child you grow up with and you just assume are the normal because it's what you're experiencing. So my great-grandfather had periods of some excruciating headaches. He also had time periods where he would sort of blank just temporarily. The family said they were time periods where he would black out. One of these happened while he was driving with my great-grandmother. Fortunately, they weren't going very fast, and they ended up in the ditch, but nobody was hurt. After that, he just stuck to the gravel roads. That was the way of coping with it. And then after he had passed away, I started reading some other information from his daughters and found out that there was also a time period where he had a fairly violent temper. That, fortunately, was short-lived. It was after the war. And then they immigrated to America in 1923. By the time I met him, he was a quiet, gentle little man who spoke mostly German still, although he could speak and understand English. He still preferred to use German. And I was with him on an occasion when he had a sort of a blanking out moment. We were feeding sheep together, and he just sort of seemed dazed for a second or two. But as a child, you just don't think anything of it. So in researching this book and researching Shell Shock and in researching his history, I discovered where he actually was during the First World War. I had heard as a child he went missing behind enemy lines for a period of 2 weeks. And when I tracked down where that was, I was horrified because it was the worst front that we know in Verdun, where there was intense shelling. So I realized probably what we'd seen, what we'd heard about was no doubt shell shock.
And so tell me, as you started doing this research, when you first started having questions about shell shock being different than what we define as post-traumatic stress disorder, because a lot of the things that you mentioned, these are things that people with PTSD can experience.
Well, and that was the biggest discovery. So when I do research, I like to go to primary sources. So if you look at something online about some of the doctors who first mentioned shell shock, Charles Myers was the doctor who was first credited with coming up with the term. But if you go to his original research, which you can just go to The Lancet online and you can find it, the patients he were describing were all unconscious for a period of time. He wrote about three different soldiers, and they all were in the symptoms with nervousness, trembling, shaking, et cetera, afterwards. But all three of those men had been either what they called blown up by a shell, which means that the shell was near you and the dirt and the earth came over the top of you, or you were actually physically blown off the ground. Oftentimes, the men appeared physically unhurt. They couldn't see any damage. So what you can't see, you have to speculate about. And the biggest problem was for the military to come to terms with the vast number of men with the symptoms that they were seeing, the nervousness, the nightmares, the shaking, the trembling, the depression, the confusion, all of the things which we now have accepted as common symptoms of PTSD, which if you listen to the term, where is the word war in that? And in this research, I actually started to uncover what I felt was a deliberate conspiracy by military authorities to hide from the civilian population the actual facts, which they knew about the injuries to the brain caused by blast forces. They today know that there are brain injuries caused by blast forces in, they call TBIs, traumatic brain injuries. But the military still does not want to acknowledge the extent of the number of men that suffer from it or the extent to which even a continued repeated small exposure will cause a brain injury. It's sort of like the NFL with coming to terms with finally admitting, yes, this does cause a concussion. So in this research, I found there were a few doctors early on, even as early as the Crimean War, who were talking about what they were seeing as far as nervous conditions and the symptoms that we've heard about. And it very quickly, the military gave order to Charles Myers, the doctor who used the term shell shock in the First World War, we're not going to use that term anymore. The military is against having any articles about shell shock published. They allowed it to be called war neuroses. Then they dropped the word war. Then it was just simply called neuroses. And they very quickly were able to say, well, we have found a few soldiers who were never near the front who have these symptoms. Or we have found civilians who, if they heard about the war, they have these symptoms. They just never had them to the extent that the men, the soldiers, had them.
Interesting. So you feel like, from what your research, that there is, because of the blast force, the injuries that can be sustained if you are close to shelling, that it's similar to getting a concussion? It is a concussion.
It is a concussion.
It is a concussion.
It's a different type of concussion. You can look online and see what does blast forces do to your brain. There's an overpressure wave, and then there's the reduction in the wave, and there's the pressure. But your brain is a fluid-filled organ, and so is your spine. And so that also is magnifying and changing the forces. One of the things that I read that was interesting was the very worst place to be is in a trench or against a wall, because that just reflects. It gives it more surfaces to bounce. They almost would have been better off. And actually, I put this in a line in the play. They'd be better off lying out in the open without their helmets. Hmm. The helmet's protected from shrapnel, but the metal itself magnified the concussion.
Wow. So do you feel like the brain injuries sustained with shell shock are similar to CTE, or the chronic traumatic encephalopathy,
yeah,
that we're hearing so much about with the NFL?
Yes, I absolutely do. After reading about it, it would be hard to draw any other conclusion. The doctors that they took apart who were saying that this was the case, they went after them. For one man, it was with his religion. He was a Jewish doctor, and they were able to denigrate his findings. And in the other cases, it was because if they proved this true, the military would have to pay pensions for all of those men. And how could they ever afford that? And if this proved true, how would they ever recruit for the next war? And there's estimates, Walter Reed will admit, 59% of soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan have mild TBI. But what we don't know is, what are the results of mild TBI? And isn't it better to have that fact, so that instead of thinking it's a neurotic tendency, it's because my mother over-nurtured me. You should see the list of questions that they asked in World War II of men suffering from shell shock. It's absolutely absurd. I put it into the play as well. Was your father too strict? It's outrageous. So, but what that's saying is, what is it about you that made you get this?
Right.
So it puts the blame on the man.
All right. So I'm sure there are people
thinking,
it's
a lot of information.
So how do we get from here to a new play? When did this research make you think, oh, I need to write a play?
Because I have written, I did present a paper, a proper-ish paper, to the Society of the History of Medicine Society. And that was very interesting, and it was a wonderful experience. But it's not dramatic, and it cannot, I'd have to write a book to cover all of this information, and I want people to be aware of it and know of it. Because if you talk to people about shell shock, they've seen the videos, and usually they're narrated with a very soft voice. These men whose minds were shattered, these men it's a little absurd. So I wanted to dramatize what I knew in order to make it accessible to everyone, so that you could go in and change your idea, or at least go do the research yourself and look up the studies. So it became a play set in France, an expeditionary British hospital, and with our company and several other people, directed by Rachel Lindhart.
Well, and tell me a little, give me the synopsis. Tell me a little bit more about what it's about.
There are 35 people in the cast, and it is, the synopsis is that it is a group of doctors and nurses who are coming to terms with the military's suppression of the information that they are just finding out about what is actually happening with the men that they're treating on a particular ward where the cases of shell shock were placed. And it also includes at the end another tiny unknown fact about World War I, in that where did all these patients stay? When you think about it, they had thousands and thousands of men who needed a place to go that were wounded. So what they did is they cleared out asylums. They cleared out what were then unfortunately called lunatic asylums. They cleared out hospitals, and they put the soldiers there. But what happened to those patients? So there's a very interesting article entitled "The Extraordinary Deaths Amongst Asylum Patients in the Great War, 1914-18. So without any place to go, they were virtually homeless, or they put them in monasteries. They put them in any other secondary place. And they, in one hospital in France, 2,000 patients died during the war that were long-term patients, people with mental illness, people with severe learning disabilities that were no longer able to be cared for by their families, who had been there as long-term patients. So we also have that at the very end. And yet it's a holiday show.
It's a holiday show.
It is a holiday show because the only thing you can have hope is that when people do learn things, that they're changed by it, that they're altered by it, and also that their perceptions of others change.
Now, we've talked about combined efforts theater on the program in the past, but let's just review. This is an unusual performance group as well. Combined efforts theater is a collaboration between actors with and without disabilities. And you're the founder of this group, but why in particular do you think that this is really the perfect performance troupe to put on this play?
Well, we have a new artistic director this year, Andrew Tubbs, who's in music here in a graduate program at the University of Iowa. And he and I had been talking about how our plays often don't focus at all on disability. They're just plays about things in history or a variety of different topics. But I talked in particular about this one because we're talking about brain injury. And we're also talking, of course, with war about physical disabilities. So he said it's a perfect fit. It's a difficult fit in some ways for the dance team plays the asylum patients. And I had a conversation with the parent saying, how do you feel about having your child who does have a disability portraying somebody who has a disability? How are you uncomfortable with that? And she said, well, tell me about the asylum patients. And I said, well, they were people who would have had things like Down syndrome. Sometimes they would have been people with learning disabilities or physical disabilities or mental illness who, for whatever reason, could not be cared for by their family. And she said, well, that's them then, isn't it? That would have been them. That would have been their history. So I think that they should play it. And I was very moved by that, that she felt for you to play your own history is extremely important.
Well, and I can imagine, though, that there would be difficulty in that, you know, in the environment that we're raising children with these same disabilities in now, hopefully, is so much warmer, so much more accepting, so much more empowering, trying to explain the kind of discrimination or the lack of understanding to some of these younger people who have these disabilities. I mean, has that been difficult?
Not really. Actually, there's a quick acceptance to understand that things were different in the past and that things were not as fair or, you know, that people were not treated as well. And I think everybody is able to understand that. So has not really presented a problem. They'll say that's sad or that's wrong, but they're certainly aware.
Well, and in your past performances, you don't cast someone based on their disability.
No, and again, with this, there's a mix, too, throughout the play with the nursing staff and with some of the patients. So it's you're not cast because of one thing or another.
So seeing your work come to life in this way, tell me about the experience. What is it? I mean, obviously, the show opens December 15th, so it's not in its final form.
Not quite yet. Yes.
But
we're getting there.
Seeing it come to life with these actors, tell me about the experience for you as the writer.
It's been a wonderful experience. The actors have made such phenomenal growth in even just the past. I missed a couple of days of rehearsal because I'm not directing the show. And when I came back, I was really astonished at the progress everybody had made, that sinking into character, the connecting with other characters. And I found myself just watching the rehearsal and not thinking about any notes or anything that needed changing in the script or anything, but just being invested in their performance at that exact moment. And that's what you want to see.
As the writer, do you find that when a play is taking on a life of its own, that you often need to go back and make changes to the script to suit the actors and the interplay?
For a variety of reasons, sometimes to fit the actor, but most often to fit something that isn't working in the interaction between the characters. But what's wonderful about original work and this cast is everybody is willing to give me a note. And so I've gotten page-long emails, but it's so helpful, and it's important because then I feel that people really care about what they're saying, and they'll do their own research. And we made a correction last night because there's a line, just don't play God Save the Queen. And there was a king on the throne at that time, so it should have been God Save the King. So that sort of thing has been really nice, too.
You produce a lot of original work, and you're quite a prolific playwright. When you write a play and it's put on by your company, what happens to the work next? Is this something that you make available to other people?
Yes and no. It depends upon the play and the group that would be involved. I have had work produced other places that I've written. That's a really excellent question. Where would you submit it? It's a 35-person show. A lot of theaters aren't really willing to take that on unless it's that blockbuster musical, right? So, it's always kind of on to the next thing. I should mention one more thing. There were hardtack was served at that time period. So there's two things interesting in the lobby. One, there's a trench. Two, we have at two different performances speakers coming in to give 15-minute presentations, one from the Department of History and Donna Hurst from the curator at the John Martin Rare Book Room at Hardin Medical Library is giving a talk on foods. And with her talk on foods, Jamie Powers of Summit Street Bakery is creating, kind of based on the original Huntley Palmer hardtack biscuit, a biscuit to serve as well. So our patrons will go to a Red Cross canteen instead of the concession stand. And Iowa City Community Theater has been very lovely in allowing us to sneak in their space for this week and then through the run, the weekend that the show is on. So I'm very grateful to Brenda Christner and the theater company, Iowa City Community Theater.
And that's out at the...
It's out at the Johnson County Fairgrounds. Both the outgoing director, Brian Tanner, and the incoming director, Barry Schreier, of those two shows have been fantastic in working us into their space needs.
So it'll be a history lesson, but also an emotional journey as well.
I hope so, and I hope an educational one particularly.
Janet, thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's always a delight.
Janet Schlopkel is the founder of Combined Efforts Theater. She is the writer of the new play, Shell Shocked, the holiday show this year. It opens December 15th, four shows over that weekend out at the Johnson County Fairgrounds. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.